Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
I need a framework that helps me make sense of my emotional response to suffering as well as my intellectual response to it.
You have to say that the reason that God allows for evil is because it comes to a greater good in the end. It's like spending money to make money. And the reason you can say that is because the Christians tell you. They say that God is all loving. So he's all powerful and all loving. So any evil that we see in the world, when we look at it and we go, that looks truly gratuitous, that looks like that's really bad. Under the Christian worldview, it's not bad.
I actually disagree with that. The Christian faith speaks of a God who hasn't just called out instructions on how to cope with suffering in whatever form it might come to us. He has actually climbed down into human history himself as the person of Jesus Christ and has looked hurting people in the eye.
This is the great problem.
Hello and welcome to the Unbelievable podcast, the show where Christians and non-Christians come together to debate the topics that matter to all of us. I'm your host, Ruth Jackson, and today we're diving into another live debate on the really pertinent topic, why does God allow suffering? This discussion addresses the tension between an all-powerful, all-loving God and the reality of pain and suffering in the world. We're going to be asking questions like, is suffering part of God's plan? And how do Christians reconcile a good God with the suffering that we see? We're delighted to have teamed up once again with Aylesbury Vale Youth for Christ to bring you this debate, which was recorded live at Aylesbury High School with Dr. Sharon Dirks and Stephen Woodford. This is actually their second unbelievable discussion on this topic, so I will make sure that the details of their first show, which went out earlier this year in May, are in the show notes. Stephen Woodford is a popular, influential YouTuber whose channel Rationality Rules aims to dismantle religious and supernatural beliefs. Dr. Sharon Dirks has a PhD in brain imaging from Cambridge University, and she's written two books on suffering, including her most recent book, Broken Planet. Let's head back to school for round two of Dr. Sharon Dirks and Stephen Woodford discussing suffering. Would you just maybe articulate why suffering is a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. Thanks for being here as well. And we're talking about real life questions here when we think about the question of suffering. You know, why are there diseases? Why are we dealing with cancers? Why was there COVID, the pandemic, the natural disaster that came to all of our own front doors just a couple of years ago? Why do we struggle with mental health, be that in our own life or in the lives of other people? And we're actually, you know, wrestling with real life matters. And I guess at the heart of the kind of dilemma and the thing that people wrestle with is, you know, if you want to bring God into the picture, then it seems like it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up because we seem to, Christians seem to believe in a God who is all powerful and therefore has, in theory, the ability to either create a world in which there is no suffering or do something about it to step in and stop it from happening. And it says that he's all good and actually has the desire to want to make the world a better place or, you know, do something about people's suffering. And so the fact that we live in a world which is rife with suffering, be that in terms of how people treat each other and things happening to our bodies and things happening in nature, like earthquakes and tsunamis, those things are real and actually widespread. People reach the conclusion that either God doesn't exist, because if he did, he would do something about it, or perhaps even worse, he does exist, but he's not all powerful. He's some frail old man where the events of life are spiraling out of control. Or even worse than that, he's not actually good. He's not a good God. And I think that's probably where a lot of people land, that actually, that God is actually malevolent. He's evil. He's the one causing it. And so I think that's at the heart of the dilemma that a lot of people have around this topic. And obviously, I'm a Christian. I haven't always been a Christian. I actually grew up in a religiously neutral home. Started asking questions in my late teens and arrived at university to study biochemistry and actually change my views about God. And that's a whole process I could talk to you about if you wanted to ask me. But I believe that actually there are ways of, not that we have all of the answers, and we're not here to even remotely claim that that can be done actually, but that there are frameworks for making sense of why a good God exists, and that there's the reality of suffering and evil in the world, and that those things can actually be held together.
Thanks, Sharon. Stephen, do you think the problem of suffering is only a problem if you bring God into the picture? Is it not a problem from an atheistic or naturalistic perspective?
Yes.
Worldview?
Yeah. Okay, so we're all born and we tend to be taught the religion of our families. So if you're born in a Muslim household, you're going to be taught about the Quran, you're going to be taught about Allah. If you're born in a Christian household, you're going to be taught about Yahweh, you're going to be taught about the Christian God. And if you're born in a Hindu household, you're going to be taught about the multiple gods. And if you're born in a non-religious household, you might not be taught anything. Now, I happen to have grown up in a Christian household, not very Christian, but enough for me to, that was what I was told. That's what I was told by my peers, this is what's true. And when you start experiencing life and you start looking at the world around you, you notice that there's lots of evil things in the world, as you've covered. Earthquakes, dinosaurs going extinct, all of these bad things. And you start thinking, how does this work with the worldview, with the religion that I've been taught? Now, suppose that you're a Hindu. If you're taught that there's evil in the world, you can actually make sense of this data because you're not told that God is all-powerful and all-loving. So there is going to be evil in the world. End off, not a problem. If you're an atheist like me, someone that doesn't believe in any of the religions, you're going to be able to say, yeah, there's evil in the world. All we can do about it is look at it and do our best to fix it. That's our job, that's our role. But there is evil in the world. Whereas if you're told that God is all powerful, it means that God can do anything, anything that's not a contradiction. And if you're told that he's all loving, then you're being told that he will do everything that is going to maximize love. It naturally follows from that there is no such thing as evil. Everything that we perceive as evil actually isn't evil, it's for the greater good. And this is why it's a problem for people that hold it, that kind of God, which is what you get in Christianity and you get in Islam. Whereas as an atheist, as a naturalist, there is no problem to solve here in terms of trying to understand why evil exists. However, we should do everything in our power to try and alleviate it.
So it's just part of the natural world, just exists.
Yep, it's just part of the natural world. It's not a contradiction. An atheist worldview can easily make sense of that data.
Great. I'm aware that in the first show that you guys did that went out, I think, on the 3rd of May, we covered quite a lot of the origins of where suffering came from, how you both account for the problem of suffering. So I'm really keen to get to the response. How do we cope with suffering? How do we manage our suffering? What hope is there in our suffering? But it is also important to look a little bit about where it did come from. So Sharon, would you mind just very briefly, if you can, summarising why does God allow suffering then? You've articulated the problem, but what would you say?
Well, I think it's helpful first to ask the question that if God doesn't exist, what kind of explanations are there? And to some extent, I would agree with Stephen. I think that, what we can see, people that perhaps don't, believe in God, we would all look to scientific explanations. I'm a scientist by background. We have a lot to learn there. And what we see is a lot of the mechanisms behind disease and sickness actually have a life-giving role ultimately, but somehow they've gone wrong. So viruses, take viruses, for example. You may know already that there are actually billions of viruses floating around the biosphere. 99.99% of them are not harmful to humans or to life. In fact, they're essential. And if we got rid of all viruses in the world, we'd survive for about a day and a half, and then we'd all die. Actually, they play a vital role. They keep bacterial populations from taking over. They enable plankton to thrive, which keeps oxygen in its good proportions in the atmosphere. So basically, they are vital for life, but occasionally they seem to go rogue and things happen. Same with cancers. Cancers develop when the good and necessary process of cell division runs out of control. But if cell division obviously is happening all the time in our bodies, if it stopped, we would die. But somehow it's gone wrong. And so I guess a scientist would say that actually a lot of the mechanisms that even lead to physical, biological disease are life-giving mechanisms, but somehow they have gone wrong. But I guess I would agree with what Stephen said there, which is that this is just the way the world is. These are just events. They're biological events. And there's nothing right or wrong about the fact that they are, that they're just part of life. They're just part of the world. And I guess the point for me that I see as being an inconsistency with atheism is that we don't respond to them as if they're just the way the world is. We actually respond to them we get angry. We talk about fighting cancer. That's what all the slogans are about. Why fight an event if that's just the way the world is? And we battle mental health. Why do we talk in these kind of emotional terms about it? And so for me, the inconsistency with the atheistic view is, why do you do that if this is just the way the world is, if there's nothing right or wrong about it? And actually, the way that we respond to suffering is as though something is wrong with the world. And actually, the Christian framework makes sense of that. It says you don't need to ignore that, you don't need to suppress it, you don't need to transcend it using spiritual techniques. It actually gives voice to that sense of wrongness and rawness at the way the world is, because it says, yes, you are absolutely right, something is wrong. We live in a world that is both beautiful and broken. And the reason for that is that God is good and exists and has made a good world, but with the potential for it to go wrong. And somehow that potential became actual. And that's, we're talking about things that are right back in the history of humankind, of life on Earth. But your instinct that there is something wrong is correct, but that makes more sense if God exists than if he doesn't.
Stephen, I want to give you a chance to respond to that, but I also want to ask, for many people, mm-hmm. the problem of suffering is the reason they don't believe in God.
Yep.
Is that where you would stand as well, if it's not too personal a question?
No, you can ask any personal question, absolutely fine.
Noted, guys.
So, no. I would say that there's lots and lots of reasons for my atheism, lots of reasons why I do not think God exists. And also, it depends on the God. So if you have a God, say the Hinduism pantheon, if you have gods where they don't entail that there's no such thing as evil, then the problem of evil is just not a problem for them. And so obviously any concerns about the problem of evil isn't going to have any effect on those views. So no, I find that, say, for example, Sharon brought up cancer and the way that it can go wrong. A naturalist, an atheist, can look at cancer and go, yeah, that's cell division going wrong. That's what's happening. Why is it happening? Well, we're an evolved species. That's what's happening. It's not perfect. Evolution's not perfect. It doesn't want to be perfect. It wants these differences. Consequently, you do have problems like that, and that you can just make sense of the data it's done. Whereas the Christian has to look at that and say, this actually isn't really evil. What's going on here is actually the best of all possible worlds, as they say in the literature. They're saying this is the absolute best that God could do. So what they invite us, and in fact need us to believe, is that a relative dying from cancer is actually the best thing that could have happened. And the way that they make sense of that framework is they start talking about heaven. You get an infinite reward afterwards, and that makes sense of the punishment. Well, most Christians don't believe someone like me is going to heaven, so there is no reward if I get cancer. And basically, this is where so much inconsistency is coming across. You mentioned that as an atheist, I can't really account for why we care to change things. Why would you say that? Like, what makes you think that that's a thing? To make sense of the data that we want to change the world, you said that you can only really make sense of that data if you believe in God.
Well, I didn't say those words.
That was that's what you've heard.
I guess I was saying that actually that we both agree that there are scientific reasons that can be given as to why diseases exist, and that enables us to see them as biological events. But as human beings, we don't respond to them just as biological events. We grow in our understanding through the biology, but we respond to them in an emotional way. And I think we need answers that help us make sense of suffering, both intellectually and in terms of our intuitive emotional response, that this is not right, this shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, and I guess my question is, why do you think that I don't have that?
Well, I'm not saying that you don't have that, not right. For one moment, but I'm just saying, what is the best framework that makes sense of it?
Because I guess I could frame it this way. How does naturalism not make sense of that data?
Well, what are your grounds for saying anything is wrong in the world?
Okay, so if you believe in God or you don't believe in God, you can say that the way that we got here is via natural selection, via evolution. And what that's imbued in us is social software. It's software. We're not born with a blank slate. We're born believing things. We're born having certain intuitions, certain feelings. And one thing that pretty much everyone has, including non-human animals, is an avoidance of suffering. We don't want it. Now, if you want to know why we don't want it, it's because if you allow suffering, you could end your life prematurely and thus not be able to proliferate, not be able to continue your lifeline. So evolution has this reason to select in us a deep desire to want to make the world, quote, better for us, to make it so that we can live longer and more prosperous lives. So that is where that intuition's coming from, by my lights. And even if I believed in God, I would think that that's the way that God put that in us. It's how he wired it in us.
Yeah, I definitely see that that's one way of making sense. You know, there's different arguments for where, I guess, like our sense of right and wrong come from. And one of them is from natural processes. And I can see that, you know, human beings wanting to be kind of kind to each other could be an argument for why we sort of have this intuition and this ability to be kind and do noble things to each other. But there are also alternative explanations that you could use under an evolutionary framework as well. You know, equally, the species could survive if you decide to kind of, you know, rape all the women. And that would lead to another set of moral apparatus that would emerge and would enable survival of the species. Or you could say, look, let's get rid of all the elderly population. They've outlived their usefulness in terms of the gene pool and their genetic material. And so let's wipe them out. And that would also enable survival, but would lead to a different set of moral apparatus. But there's nothing in the mechanism itself that says any one of those is better than the other.
Okay.
But right. And so what we're doing is appealing to a standard outside of those processes. And I'm just actually nudging to say, what is that?
Yeah,
you know, that actually points more towards God than towards nature.
Yeah, great rejoinder. And I think there's two things I want to say about it. First of all, Charles Darwin actually mentioned this criticism in his Origin of Species. And what he said was, if you had two tribes, one tribe is actually really aggressive and it will harm people, and the other tribe is much more caring. They love their neighbor, if you will. Which of those tribes has a higher chance of succeeding in nature? It's the one that's caring. It's the social species. That's what we are. We're a social species. We care about things. We even care about non-human animals. Lots of us do. You know, like lots of people are vegetarian, for instance. That's expanding your circle, caring about more and more and more, because that is obviously beneficial to us. Now, you mentioned about women, and you mentioned about how you could have a moral framework where women are mistreated. Naturalism will look at this and say, yes, there are situations where that can unfold, and you need to be able to make sense of that data. But suppose we look at Christianity, or we look at Islam. We've got this situation right now, or Hinduism. This is basically true of all religions. For most of the history of Christianity, women have been treated like second-class citizens. Hated, disdained. That's what's happened across the board. This isn't my opinion. This is just a fact. You can look at the data, you can read St. Augustine, you can read St. Aquinas, you can read all of these scholars, all of these theologians, the church fathers. They thought very much that Eve is below Adam. She was created from his rib. And they believe very much that women are second-class citizens. And so what have we seen throughout our society when Christianity had power? What did we see? Women having nowhere near the rights that they have today under an atheistic, egalitarian worldview. That's where that comes from. And so how do you make sense of that data? Because a naturalist can look at it and go, as we've learned more and more and more, turns out our bigotries were wrong. Turns out that we were just wrong. Women are just as capable as men, more capable in many areas. Being gay is a natural thing, and it shouldn't be penalized. There are such a thing as trans people. Like, we're expanding our circle of empathy, and we're realizing and developing as time goes on. And yet the Christian has to look at it and go, either God is changing his mind, which they don't want to say, because that would imply that God doesn't have an objective morality, because he can't say that women are second-class citizens for all of the history, and then all of a sudden, in this century, say, no, they're equal, right? That was a contradiction. Or the second thing we have to do, is say that somehow the church fathers got it wrong. Somehow St. Augustine, St. Aquinas got it wrong when he described very explicitly that women are below men. The same is done of slavery. Vast majority of Christian history has endorsed slavery, and yet they don't now. How do you make sense of this data? A naturalist, an atheist can look at it and go, religion isn't the thing. What's going on is it's more complicated than that.
I think we're both agreed, and related to your earlier point, that we're just a social species that want to be kind to each other. I think we see life is much more messy and complicated than that. People are cruel and hurtful to each other, not just within the Christian faith, actually in all walks of life. And so, you know, what you're saying is illustrating the point that the argument about just wanting the evolutionary process yielding noble social beings is not enough to make sense of the messiness of how people treat each other. We could talk about women, but actually if you go even further back in time, you will see that people like Plato and Aristotle, that vastly predate Christianity, say that women were inferior to men. But it was actually into that context that Genesis was written, that the Judeo-Christian framework speaks by saying that actually all human beings are made in the image of God, male and female, and therefore have equal dignity and value before God. It's into that. And then you actually see the life of Jesus, who also predates the church fathers. I'm not disputing the fact that they got it wrong. I actually agree with you on that. But I look at Jesus and how he treated women, and he vastly overturned the cultural norms of his day and treated women with dignity and respect, and actually trusted them with the most important news in history, arguably, the resurrection of Jesus himself, that they were the first people to be entrusted with that. He reinstated women in society. He overturned cultural norms. And of course, human beings, fallible human beings, have messed that up along the way. But actually, the mandate is a very different one to what you're articulating. Do we need to get to suffering?
We're going to take a quick break. If you're enjoying the debate and watching on YouTube, then please don't forget to hit that subscribe bell. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please give us a follow. We will be back in just a moment.
Did you know that this month marks the fourth anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. That's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the second part of today's episode of the Unbelievable podcast. We're continuing the debate between Dr. Sharon Dirks and Stephen Woodford as they explore the tough question, why does God allow suffering? If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please do follow the show and visit premierunbelievable.com where you'll find resources, articles and access to all of our past shows. And you can also sign up for updates there. Later in the show, we're going to open up the discussion to the student audience for what turns out to be a lively Q&A session. But for now, here's how the conversation carried on.
This is the great problem with religion by my lights. Everybody is convinced that their interpretation is the right one, and yet it doesn't seem to process in their head that the scholars that they rely on, the saints that they rely on, did not
believe. I don't rely on the saints, I rely on the Bible, actually.
But here's the thing. If you read Augustine and you read Aquinas, he goes, here's a quote from the Bible, here's Timothy telling you that women are to remain silent. If you read the actual stuff, they give you receipts, they actually read the literature. And yet when we get to today, and no longer is this a belief that's held by most Christians, you get this vaguity of Jesus said love your neighbour. It's not good enough is what I would contend. All I would invite everyone to do is just read the Bible, read the Quran, and you'll know who has a better grip on the literature.
And I would just encourage you to say there's a whole body of scholarship behind that and people that are actually, you know, actually looking to say what is the context and to try and make sense of those verses. I am an egalitarian. I reached that conclusion on the basis of the same verses you're referring to. So this is
the same verses.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just going to park this for a sec because this could be a whole other debate and maybe we'll invite you back to talk particularly about women leadership. But just I was really struck by something that you said and I could see you kind of being a bit uncomfortable with it, where you were saying that a Christian has to say that cancer is not evil and that actually someone who's died of cancer is the best possible thing that could have happened in this world. Sharon, I feel like you were sort of sitting uncomfortably. How would you respond to that?
No, thank you. And I actually, it highlights to me, Stephen, that actually some of the reasons I think that we've had bad experiences in terms of like how people have responded to our own suffering. And actually Christians have been insensitive at times by trying to put heavy burdens on people, trying to find reasons for why something has happened, when actually there's a lot of precedent in the Christian framework that we don't necessarily know the reasons. I think that actually it's the opposite. I think that it's precisely because God exists and evil is real that we can say this is wrong. It's precisely because of that frame that we don't need to sugarcoat something and say, no, this is God's will for you. Actually, no, the Christian framework is we live in a world where good and evil are both at work. Of course, God is greater than evil, but they're both at work. And therefore, life is messy. But I think how we respond to a person, you know, we've got these phrases in culture that say things happen for a reason. But I actually find that to be so hard, because then you're trying to figure out the reason that this is happening to you, as though no one else needed for it to happen to them. I find that to be very unhelpful. Sometimes good things can come out of suffering, but the good that can come out of it isn't the reason that it happened. The reason it happened is because the world is broken. And it certainly isn't that God is punishing a person. We never see in the life of Jesus, him like, you know, talking about God that singles people out for punishment. We never see that. We suffer because our world is broken. And everyone is caught up in it in different ways. But it's not like a lightning bolt from God to you, as if you need to learn something. It's that the world is broken. Actually, the Christian faith speaks of a God who comes alongside, who wants to come alongside people in their suffering and walk with them through it.
Thanks, Sharon. Sorry.
If I may, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so When I say that evil is not really evil under the Christian worldview, what I'm saying here is that if God is all powerful, it means that there is nothing that can affect him. He can do anything. This is what it is to be this maximally great being. And so what falls out of that is that any evil in the world that exists, God permits it. He allows it. Now, why would God permit evil? Why would he wipe out the dinosaurs, causing all of this suffering to all of these sentient creatures? Why would he have the Holocaust happen? Why would he have all of this? Why would he allow women to be mistreated for 2,000 years under his name in Jesus? What's going on? And what I'm getting at here is that you have to say that the reason that God allows for evil is because it comes to a greater good in the end. It's like spending money to make money. And the reason you can say that is because the Christians tell you. They say that God is all-loving. So he's all-powerful and all-loving. So any evil that we see in the world, when we look at it and we go, that looks truly gratuitous, that looks like that's really bad, under the Christian worldview, it's not bad. It's actually something that is the best of all possible worlds. So all of the victims of the Holocaust go to heaven.
I actually disagree with that. I think that there are some evils that are just abject evil that need to be stopped, and that's why we see throughout the Bible that the heart of God is for justice. You know, the Rwandan genocide, any genocide, the Holocaust, no, there is no greater good that came out of that. That's just when evil is allowed to run riot.
No greater good.
In a population. In that specific instance, I think that good can come out of it and has come out of it. But I don't think that we need to kind of fit inside the framework of there must be a greater good for this horrendous evil. There can be good,
but
there doesn't need to be. And I know that you like to hold on to that, and unless I agree to it, my whole argument falls apart. But
it's actually the contrary.
There are reasons that the whole biblical framework is that there are some reasons we can get a handle on. But there is also a sense in which God's ways are beyond our understanding, and that we're never going to get a completely bottomed out, kind of sorted, you know, black and white explanation of why God allows some things. And just because we can't comprehend any possible reason doesn't mean there aren't any.
Agreed.
It just means they're beyond our capacity to understand.
Do you mind if I move us on, thank you, Sharon, to how we respond to suffering? Because I feel like we've done a really good job, and obviously it's come into it a little bit. We've chatted about the origin, we've chatted a little bit about the response, but how would you say, Stephen, that an atheist, naturalistic worldview helps us in our suffering? What hope does it bring us in our suffering?
Yes, what hope does it bring? Okay, I don't mean to be rude, but I want to put one final cherry on top of that. If somebody says that God is all powerful and is all good, and then says that there are such things as evils that don't lead to a greater good, I think they fundamentally don't understand the position. There's no nice way of saying that, but that's what the logic is. You can't, that's just a contradiction, you can't have that, which is why I think a lot of the Christians that commented on Unbelievable were saying, Sharon, you don't seem to understand the premise there. So, hope under atheism.
Well, can I respond
to
that?
Of course.
Sure,
briefly?
Yes.
Every belief system has its seeming inconsistencies. The question is, are these fatal to the whole belief system or not? Your worldview has the inconsistency of it doesn't allow me to call something wrong or evil in the first place. It doesn't have an objective framework for making sense of that, and it doesn't allow me to kind of say that this is not the way the world should be, and actually that is for me a more serious inconsistency, because our emotions are with us all day every day, and I need a framework that helps me make sense of my emotional response to suffering as well as my intellectual response to it.
I'll also just say, I did a show, so one of the sort of spin-offs of Unbelievable was called Unapologetic. I did a show with a guy called Dr. Michael Lloyd, whose whole PhD is in the cosmic fall. So he would absolutely agree with Sharon that you can say that some suffering is just evil, that it's totally antithetical to the will of God. But anyway, do check that out if you want to find out more about
that
position.
Yeah, I just encourage people to look it up. Yeah. Just see who's right on this one. That's probably the best thing to do. On the natural point that you make, I don't think you've done the job of showing that I can't account for it, but I don't want to go back and forth too much on that, so I'll move on to your question with hope, which is what hope do you have as an atheist, right? Okay, so I think that our hope for a better world, the first thing we need to do is accept reality on reality's terms. Our intuitions of thinking that we're more than what we are, our intuition of thinking, yeah, we really matter. We're not really going to die. We're going to live forever. this actually causes us not to make the world a better place. So when an atheist, when a naturalist sees evil in the world, when they see poverty, when they see violence, when they see these bad things in the world, this is our only opportunity to fix this. Every person who dies and doesn't have a fixture, we need to venerate them. We need to make sure that we fix those problems to the best of our ability. That's all we've got. There is no hint out there that anything is going to save us from ourselves. It's all on us. And so the hope, the drive behind making the world a better place, is by recognizing the real state that we're in. Whereas by my lights, under a religious framework, this isn't needed. Things are going to be put right. There's no need to fix these things. Now, this isn't to say that religious people don't try and fix problems. Of course they do. It's something that they're commanded to do. There's a pillar in Islam, for instance, that says that you've got to look after others. But when it comes to the hope of a better world, the atheist and the naturalist, they have it rawly in their hands. This is our only opportunity, and all we can do is our best. And if we do our best, that is good enough.
Thank you. So how does a Christian worldview, let's just respond to what Stephen said, there is a sense in which perhaps there's hope for a better life, but how does a Christian worldview help someone right in the middle of their suffering right now?
So the author Brené Brown talks about the scenario when someone is in a pit, you know, that they're in deep darkness and they're in a pit. There's a difference between the empathetic person and the sympathetic person. The sympathetic person stands at the top of the pit, calling out instructions to the person in the pit. Do better at this, try harder at this, work at this, whatever. The empathetic person climbs down the ladder into the pit and says, I am here with you. You are not on your own. The Christian faith speaks of a God who hasn't just called out instructions on how to cope with suffering in whatever form it might come to us. He has actually climbed down into human history himself as the person of Jesus Christ and has looked hurting people in the eye and done something about their suffering, treated them with dignity and respect, healed the sick, even raised the dead. But even more than that, at the heart of Christian faith is a God who knows what it is to suffer himself, because Jesus ended his days on earth on a cross, the most degrading and humiliating way to die. And so he knows what it is to suffer. And somehow through his suffering has actually provided a way for us to know him in our suffering. Whatever the reasons we may arrive at for why there is suffering in the world, Christian faith says if you talk to God about your suffering, you're talking to a God who has not left you on your own, who actually knows what it is to suffer. He's not aloof, not indifferent, but is actually right there with you in it, and actually wants to walk with us through whatever it is that we're going through. And so it's actually, there's a verse in a book called Psalms that says that God is a very present help in time of trouble. And I have known that to be the case in very real ways throughout my life as a Christian, since I came to know the person of Jesus at 20 years old. Not that life has been easy, not that it's been straightforward. We've had all kinds of things that we've been wrestling with, but that is the reality. But then even more than that, the Christian faith does say, quite differently to the atheistic viewpoint, that this life isn't all that there is. And the reason we know that is because Jesus didn't stay on the cross. He actually rose from the dead. There are all kinds of critiques as to why people might think that didn't happen. You can also read those books. The Case for Christ is a good one about a journalist who investigated all the alternative explanations and arrived at the conclusion Jesus must have risen. And what that means is that this life isn't all that there is. There is actually life beyond this one. And so we have hope for today in the gritty messiness of life, but there's also hope for the future, that what, even though our life is hard here, there is hope beyond. And there's a verse that says, by Jesus' wounds, the wounds on the cross, we are healed. And ultimately, that is true for everyone that asks for it, in the sense that we are all healed in the afterlife, in the life to come. That is what the Christian faith believes. It says that actually our perspective on suffering is only partially complete because it's not finished yet. God isn't finished doing what he's doing in human history. There's still more to come.
If we've got time, I'd actually love to talk about healing sort of here on earth. But before we do that, would you say then that like the afterlife, eternal life, heaven, all of that is just like a helpful fiction to help people?
I don't think it's entirely that. I think there are some reasons to think. I mean, like, if you think about what we know about the world, we know so much about the world because of the information that we are exposed to. But if you go back into a wild state in nature, you don't know what's going on in here. You don't know you've got a brain. I mean, the Egyptians famously pulled the brain out of their nose because they thought the thinking was done at the heart, because that's what their intuition told them. And so I think when it comes to believing in something more, believing in supernatural things, I think that's a natural thing that humans have. And I think you can't just explain that by saying it's hopeful. But suppose someone comes up to you and they say, here is, I've got $1 million, million quid. I spent too much time with Americans. £1 million, and it's just outside, okay? All you got to do is come outside. Come take the £1 million. You just got to believe the money's there. We will look at that situation and rightfully think this is unlikely to be true. It sounds too good to be true. Well, what if they add extra things to it? What if they say to you, not only are you going to be rich in material, you're actually more importantly going to be rich in your spirituality, your loved ones. They're still alive. They're outside. They're going to live forever. Everyone's maximally happy. We, every day when we get claims that are just too good to be true, we look at them and go, yeah, we should look at this with skepticism. And yet that's what Christianity is saying. But if you look at the details, it's actually worse than that. So Sharon was saying, and a lot of Christians will say, that there is this hope, this salvation to, you know, live for eternity and whatnot. Is that true of atheists? Did Jesus preach that? Did he not say that you will only get to heaven if you believe in me? Does not Islam teach that the infidel is going to hell? There's no reward for people like this. And yet, what would a good God do? If God was all powerful and he was all loving, would he really eternally send someone away from him because they can't convince themselves that Muhammad split the moon? Because they can't convince themselves that Jesus resurrected? This isn't congruent. This isn't, you're not describing a loving God here. You're describing anything but. And so when it comes to the hope question, it's not just about hope for an afterlife. It does also have the intuition involved.
Well, and actually, one aspect of the life to come is justice. That actually, it's a point at which there would be ultimate justice, and where there has not been justice here on earth, even if it's in a very small way or if it's in a much bigger way, that actually everyone will stand before God and give an account of why they've lived the way that they have lived. And actually, God is not, the God that Christians believe in is not one that carries out miscarriages of justice. He actually knows perfectly the condition of the human heart of every person, and there will be justice. And actually, the whole question of, you know, of justice is precisely in the context of God being a God of love. If you think about when something horrible happens to a friend or family member, we actually get angry about that. We actually don't just sit back and say, oh, well, this is just the way the world is. We get angry about that. And that's because we care about that person. And actually, and so right, kind of justice and love are actually two sides of the same coin. The God at the heart of the Christian faith is a God who cares about evil. He doesn't just sit and let it happen indifferently. He does plan ultimately to bring about justice in an ultimate sense once and for all, even if human attempts at it have failed in this life. And that's because he loves people. That's because he's a God of love. And the invitation to know him is radically inclusive. It's available to everyone and anyone.
Is it available to the atheist?
Absolutely.
Do you think that someone who doesn't believe that Jesus resurrected and doesn't believe Christianity is true is going to heaven?
I am not in a position to make that decision.
I didn't ask you to make the decision. I'm just saying, is it consistent for a God to punish someone for not believing things that are really unlikely?
I'm not gonna, actually, I feel like you're asking me to, to kind of think about something that's too black and white.
Yeah.
And actually, we're talking about a God that knows us better than we know ourselves. He knows our motives. He knows our past. He knows our heart. He knows our history. And he judges perfectly.
I guess I'll just leave on that note then.
I'm not in a position to know the condition of somebody's heart.
Yeah. I think that you have to appeal to the ambiguity here and the epistemic limits that we have, because you know in your heart of hearts that it is just grossly wrong to have anyone be put in any form of hell for eternity for anything. But that would be my view on it. I think that's what's going on.
Can we just spend a couple of minutes talking about unanswered prayer? Sharon, this is such a difficult topic, but I'm assuming that in your life as a Christian, you've presumably prayed for people who've been sick, who you believe have got better because of your prayers. Yeah. But I'm also imagining that the reverse is true, that people you've prayed for who have been sick haven't got better. Just to chuck a personal example, I had a friend of mine in her early 20s who'd been battling cancer for years, died just last week, even though we'd been praying for her. Why is it, do you think, that God does seem to heal some people but doesn't heal others?
Yeah, again, we're into really kind of area of mystery. I don't want to claim to have all the, you know, how could I even possibly claim to do that? Some things that come to mind on this really heartfelt topic is that when people came to Jesus for healing, everyone was healed. There were no exclusions in the person of Jesus. Regardless of background, economic status, particular beliefs at that point, everyone was healed. One of the other things that Jesus began to say when he started to have a public ministry in first century Palestine, he said that the kingdom of heaven has come near to you. And that's what Christians believe happened with the arrival of God himself in human form, that heaven broke into earth in a new way for the first time. And some of the signs of that happening were that we saw people healed, we saw people raised from the dead. All kinds of extraordinary things that go beyond the natural happened. And so when we pray for, and that is still the case, that hasn't stopped actually, and to be like a Christian is to be part of the kingdom of heaven. When we pray for healing for somebody and we see them healed, that is another reminder, another signpost that heaven has broken into earth. Anyone that wants to can be part of it. And it looks so different to the kind of slightly grey and more difficult existence of ordinary life. But when we pray for healing for someone and they're not healed, what it doesn't mean is you didn't have enough faith. You never see Jesus say that to anyone. What it doesn't mean is you didn't pray enough. It definitely doesn't mean you're being punished by God for something. It simply means actually we live in a world that is still broken, that there's still a brokenness there, and the story isn't finished. Actually, that will be one day, that heaven will be fully established on earth. At the moment, it's only partially. We still see glimpses, we still see signposts, and one day it will be fully established. That is available to everyone. And in that sense, everyone that asks for healing will be healed, but not necessarily right now. And I guess I say all that and it makes sense intellectually perhaps. And I know that the reality of it is just very hard and very painful. I've been, our own sort of situation and the different things we've wrestled with have brought this home in real ways as well.
Thanks, Sharon. Stephen, how would you respond to that, firstly, but also what would you say is happening? You clearly don't believe that prayer works. So what would you say is happening in those instances where people do seem to get better?
Yeah. Okay. So much time back.
Sorry. In 3 minutes.
Okay. We're told God is all powerful, which means he could just come down and go, you, my child, you are no longer sick. And we're told that happens. But despite him being all powerful, he'd do it for one person, but not for another. And we're told that it's not because they didn't exercise faith. It's not because they weren't earnest. It's not because they didn't pray. It's because the world's broken. This is not making any sense of the data. It's just some fluffy answer to be able to account why some people get better and why some people don't. Now, earlier on,
but
Sharon
mentioned
science.
But why would anyone get better if there is no God?
Because sometimes conditions are not going to kill you completely.
No, but what if, like, the instances that Ruth was talking about before we came in, of someone whose actual situation kind of mystified the medical doctors?
Yeah, so, like, we're humans. We don't know the ins and outs about everything. We're always learning more. If you speak to doctors, you mentioned about scientists earlier. An interesting fact is that the more scientific someone is, the more they understand philosophy, the less likely they are to be religious. What's going on there? What I contend is that they're learning more about the natural world, they're learning more about the details, and they end up in this situation where they go, we have a rough idea of what's going on with this cancer and this situation, but we have to exercise humility. We don't really know the ins and the outs. And although statistically, this person who has this cancer should die in terms of, like, what's likely to happen, we know that there's cases where that doesn't happen. They might have an enzyme that metabolizes in a different way, but we might not know about the enzyme. There's nothing spooky about the fact that we get it wrong. Like, yeah, we're not omnipotent. We're not like this. And so when you look at these cases where some people heal and some people don't, the naturalists, the atheists, they just look at it and go, yeah, like, sometimes the body can fight it when we don't have a cure, and sometimes you get lucky like this. There's not a contradiction or anything occurring in that case. It's just that's what's happening with people getting ill. Now, if God was really intervening, what would we expect to see? Suppose you've got someone that's lost a limb. They had their arm cut off, cut from the middle, and then you've got someone who's got cancer. If God was healing miracles, you would expect him not to just heal the ones that tend to heal themselves anyway. You would expect for him to also do miraculous claims. People would grow their limbs back. You would expect to see real, tangible, obvious signs of God, and yet it's always the vagaries. And then when we ask questions of why is it that this one person didn't heal, but this one person did, we're just told the world is broken. This isn't an explanation. This is just looking at the data and trying to find a way of how God, a good God, allowed that person to suffer and die in that way.
I actually know someone who prayed for someone who had only a partial limb, and actually it grew. I can give you their name. I'm not going to give it online. Afterwards, I'll give you their name. You can call them up.
Of course, forgive my incredulity.
You can meet the person. There are some things, I think spontaneous remission is a thing. I think that there are some scientific reasons for why sometimes the body does heal itself that lie in medical explanations. But there are also instances where there is no natural explanation to make sense of this. The only explanation to make any sense is that a being has intervened.
I don't understand how you exercise your humility. In one sense, when I'm saying logically, this should be for the greater good, you say, listen, we don't know, we need to be humble. But then you'll say something such as, there's no naturalistic explanation.
Sorry, not no naturalistic, no natural.
No natural, it's the same
thing. No, it's not the same thing. Naturalistic is a worldview, big picture. Yeah. Natural is saying just no scientific
explanation. My point stands, like, that's quite a statement to make. Like, do you know everything about nature?
Okay, I'm not claiming to know, but I'm just saying in this instance, the doctor themselves was not expecting them to heal. They're putting their affairs in order. They're actually expected to die, and so it didn't make sense medically. And the limb growing is an even more stark example of actually that they were fine without the limb. Actually, they didn't need it to survive, but it grew.
So does that mean we have this situation where someone actually needs to be healed, and God says no? But then someone doesn't need their limb, and he goes, I'll do that one.
You know, I just think God is not that binary, you know. It's actually more than just like getting God to do stuff for us, as if we need that to sort of prove him. We're actually talking about a God that cares about all of our life, cares about who we are in the world, what you want, you know, what we're supposed to be doing. And then it's about actually knowing that we're loved, regardless of all the other things coming at us, regardless of all the challenges that we're faced, that there's someone that loves us regardless, unconditionally. And it's actually so much more than just getting God to, you know, a sort of slot machine God that we put this coin in, we get this out, and we can understand and explain it. It's more mysterious, more complex than that.
We're going to take a quick break. Please don't forget to head over to premierunbelievable.com. We will be back in just a moment. We are heading into the Q&A very soon. You're listening to Dr. Sharon Dirks and Stephen Woodford debating the problem of evil. As I said earlier, I will include details of their previous episode, which went out back in May, in the show notes. If you have a question or a comment for us, then please do head over to premierunbelievable.com and do let us know what other topics you'd like to hear discussed on the show. But for now, let's get back to the debate.
So could you just explain the relationship, just to clarify what you're saying about Christianity and women?
Absolutely, yeah. So if you look at Christianity and you look especially at its historical roots, and you look at like St. Augustine and St. Aquinas, these are people that were very much championed throughout Christian history. If you look at the entirety of Christianity up until the last 100 years, when atheist enlightenment started taking roots, women are treated as second-class citizens.
The next question. Are you claiming Christianity is responsible for sexism?
Is Christianity specifically responsible for the denigration of women? No, it turns out that pretty much every religion treats women poorly. It turns out that humans have done a really bad job of looking after half the human race. You go to Hinduism, what's your reward if you're a good woman? There's some interpretations that say you get to come back as a man. That's gross, that's disgusting. And that's something that's in that religion. You look at Islam, they treat women very much as second-class citizens still today. Their testimony is only worth half that of a man's. They're all bad at it. I'm not saying that Christianity is responsible for it, and you're absolutely correct. We need to do a lot better job. Just what I'm getting at is that we're starting to get there. Giving women equal right, giving women the ability to share the stage with men, that wasn't something that was allowed. Like, we're getting into a better progress. So if you look at the UK and you look at our statistics, we're now 50% atheist, or 50% don't believe in, say, the Christian God. What's actually happening is, because we're dropping the scripture and we're dropping these views, we're starting to rethink these positions and going, it doesn't make any sense to treat women any different to men. That makes no sense whatsoever. And so what's happening is, you're correct, it's a societal change. What Christianity has to do in order to remain relevant is change with society. And what it will do is it will claim that it's responsible for the change, when it just isn't. The change is, as you rightfully pointed out, it's a multiplicity of so many different things that's coming together, most of which is non-religious. So it's a fantastic point you make. So thank you.
If I could just add the point very briefly, it's always been the case that men and women are equal in the image of God. And we see that reflected when God himself steps in as Jesus. He actually reinstates women, sets the mandate for how women should be treated. That was in the ancient world. And it was long before Christianity became established as a world religion.
Here's another question. Why would an atheist want to go to heaven if they don't believe heaven exists?
It's more the alternative, right? So if you was to say that, if you describe God as this all-powerful, all-loving God, it's to understand what that being is, to really understand what that being is, everyone would want to be with them. Because it's the best of all possible worlds. It's the absolute best being. If someone says they don't want to be around that God, they're not really making any sense, because that God is defined as the best thing possible. And yet what happens is, disbelievers, it's not that they don't want to be around such a being. It's that they just don't believe it's true. I don't believe Jesus resurrected. I don't believe Muhammad split the moon. I don't believe in the scriptures. They're written primarily by men to control society, to make sense of our intuitions. And what I'm getting at here is that if God was all loving, would he mistreat, and in an eternal way, someone who's earnestly, genuinely earnestly trying to figure out the world, and yet just can't be convinced of the proposition, can't be convinced of the claim? So I think that if you understand, like, really, if everyone understood what God was, they would want it. And as an atheist, I'd want it, but I just don't think it's true. And unfortunately, the scriptures are quite clear of what happens to people like me if it's true.
Why would a loving God be so exclusive when it comes to going to heaven and hell?
What I would say to that is, the rules that are set up by God. You can ask yourself this: would a loving being set up a situation where, if someone can't convince themselves of a miracle claim that has very low chance of being true, then they deserve to go to the default position that they've decided is the default position? What I'm getting at is that this just isn't consistent with a good God. It's not a consistent story. A good God would never be. It's an insult to such a God. If a God like that exists, by my lights, the way that I see it, Christianity has done it a disservice, especially bringing in hell. I think that's a horrible thing to attribute to a loving God. A loving God wouldn't do this. It's just not consistent. So it's more about the setup. God's responsible for setting it up, and yet God wouldn't set it up that way. And the reason we know this is it just logically follows from him being all loving. He wouldn't do this to innocent creatures.
I think just one thing to throw in there, though, and we're sort of into like the origins of why God made the world the way that he did. But one of the things that he's dignified us with is freedom, freedom to live how we want to live and make choices in the world. And that means that that has all sorts of implications. It plays into why we sometimes experience suffering at the hands of somebody else. And it plays into the whole question of how we relate to God and whether we want to or not. But I would just add that the invitation is wide. It's not exclusive. It's actually radically inclusive.
The next question. How can an atheist who lives a moral life go to hell while a murderer who believes in Jesus go to heaven?
What I would definitely want to say, first of all, is that whatever that person decided about what they believed about God, that doesn't change the need for justice. Like, the justice in the courts is still... It is possible to be reconciled to God, but you still need to go to prison. And bear the consequences of what has been done on earth. But I guess these are very hard questions to kind of deal with in a couple of minutes. But at the heart of the Christian faith is actually has said that the way to really be reconciled to God is to accept what Jesus has done on our behalf, that the things that separate us from God are actually the same for all of us, like the condition of being far from God, which Christians call sin, it is in all of us, but it looks different in different people. We also speak of a God who cares about the victims of those crimes. Those people are not unseen by God. And Jesus has come to reconcile everyone that wants to be to him. But that process was extremely costly because it meant that Jesus, the only person who never committed a crime or did anything or said anything wrong in the world, took on himself all of the evil in the world. It was all directed at one target, and that was actually incredibly costly so that forgiveness is possible. And I agree, it sounds outrageous. It does sound outrageous. It doesn't mean justice isn't needed in the courts of law, but it's actually a picture of like the radical love of God for human beings, that he knows the journey that everyone has been on. He offers an invitation. He has given his life so that people can know him.
So does that mean the perpetrator of the crime and the victim could both be in heaven together?
Actually, all of the evil of the victim and the perpetrator has been carried by Jesus. That he has carried the weight of that. That was what was happening on Calvary. It's quite hard to picture the kingdom of God because all we know is the broken messiness of life here. But that different things are happening. When you come to know God, firstly, actually you have awareness of your own brokenness and need for God. And actually that's arguably much more great and much more painful for the perpetrator to suddenly be aware of the holiness of God and what they've done. That's actually punishment in and of itself. Some people say that's like hell on earth to finally realize that, but that takes the presence of a holy God in a human heart to make them realize that. And then actually someone come to know Jesus, that's often what happens. Then God, actually, to be a Christian is to walk with God and have him change us as well and make us more fit for eternity. I don't claim to understand these things properly, but what I would say is God is good. He doesn't carry out miscarriages of justice. He cares about victims. He brings about justice for perpetrators. But the kingdom of God is a place where all of those things can be put right. And that takes more time to unpack all of that. It's messy, but God cares about justice because he's a God of love.
I'm really sorry, we've got to stop. Do you want to do 30 seconds?
That's like
15 seconds, go.
Sharon didn't answer your question. She didn't do it because they can't. This, you raise a fantastic point. No good God would punish someone that commits genocide because they, on their deathbed, said, I'm convinced of Christianity. Even if they were really convinced of Christianity, they wouldn't do that. And yet that is what you're told. And yet the atheists, not because they're a bad person, but just because they can't convince themselves of these wild propositions, are somehow deserving of hell. It's just a non-answer, and that's why it took so long to answer. This is what happens with these difficult questions. They can't answer them, and they have to talk about Jesus and love, and they can't just give you a solid answer because there is none.
No, I take my time because I care about the question. I think it's a really important question, and I want to answer it in the right way. It doesn't make any sense unless God himself says, I will come and pay the price for all of the mess in the world myself. And in doing that, make a way for anyone that wants to know the love of God to know the love of God. It doesn't make sense according to where all we can see is that the brokenness of life, but God actually is bigger than that.
I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show with my wonderful guests, Dr. Sharon Dirks and Stephen Woodford. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. Do you have questions that weren't answered today? We'd love to hear from you. Visit premierunbelievable.com to get in touch. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please do consider giving the show a follow. And remember, you can explore all of our other shows and articles on premierunbelievable.com. If you're watching on YouTube, I am reliably informed that the address will be appearing on the screen right now, premierunbelievable.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, and see you next week.